Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Konser. This week, I'll be taking you back to November of 2018, when I was joined at the Portland Book Festival by globetrotting comics artist Ollie Fitzgerald, who had just released her graphic memoir, Drawn to Berlin, Comic Workshops in Refugee Shelters and Other Stories from a New Europe. At the time, Ollie made her home in Berlin, where, among other things, she was leading visual storytelling workshops for refugees, mainly Syrian refugees. Apart from her memoir, Ollie has been a regular contributor to The New Yorker magazine. Her work has also appeared in The Guardian newspaper, Bitch magazine, and The New York Times. McSweeney's fans will recognize her as the creator of the webcomic Hungover Bear and Friends. And now, Ollie Fitzgerald, recorded at the Portland Book Festival, November 11th, 2018. Ollie Fitzgerald, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about your new book, Drawn to Berlin. It's about your experiences teaching in, shall we say, a makeshift setting. But you begin the story with a surprising reference to one of your favorite children's books, Kay Thompson's Eloise.
Right. Yeah. Well, I conducted comic workshops, comic and drawing workshops in refugee shelters in Berlin in 2015 and 2016. And that kind of formed the basis of the book, Drawn to Berlin, although there are several narrative strands that are different but related. So the story begins with a 13-year-old girl named Amira in the book, and she really liked Eloise. I mean, I would bring in different books, and there were all sorts of different ages in the workshops. So I would bring in picture books along with, you know, more adult fare, like Charles Burns's books and Joe Sacco's. But she really gravitated towards Eloise and liked to copy different characters, mostly the nanny. And she really liked sort of the curvaceous form of the nanny. And she, yeah, would also copy different sorts of embraces in romance comics that I would bring in. Yeah.
So how did you fall into this gig? You were in Germany. You'd been living there for many years. You've been traveling back and forth between the States and Europe. And your survival gig at the time was teaching English to German businessmen.
Yes. To be fair, women, but mostly men.
And you ended up in these rather temporary structures. They're very well secured. And who took you on to this position?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of accidental. I was giving workshops for women at the time and working with a group called, I think it was called Heldinnen Gesucht, maybe. And I was actually at the sort of like fair situation, and the director of the refugee shelter that I ended up working at approached me and asked me if I could maybe do a comics program for teen boys, because actually their programming lacked a sort of activities for that age group. And I think he thought, like most people think, that, you know, comics and teenage boys go together pretty well. So I started giving these workshops. But because of the nature of the physical space, the openness of it, it ended up not just being for teenage boys. The ages ranged from, you know, infants to 90-year-olds, generally, over the course of the year and a half that I sort of conducted these workshops.
You were sometimes surprised by the art that came through. And of course, you shared your own art with the refugees. Tell us some of the stories.
Yeah, some of them are heartbreaking, obviously. In the book, I tried to focus mostly on what people drew, right? Because I think one of the points of the book is to sort of get away from these mass media portrayals of asylum seekers as, you know, victims or heroes or villains. It's sort of, it's a really flattening process, I think, that happens, you know, just generally in how people who are fleeing war are portrayed right now, you know, in the sort of so-called refugee crisis. And in the book, I try to focus on, you know, small micro moments. And I think the drawing is a really good way to explore that. So, you know, there was a guy who had never drawn before who ended up drawing a leopard for like 2 hours. And it was really beautiful. And he sort of shaded it with graphite. And I think at the end felt like he had accomplished something. And, you know, I think people who are seeking asylum in countries are often denied agency and sort of reduced to numbers. You know, there's this like reduction process that happens in how people's personhood is perceived, right? And so there's this, the mass media, and then it's sort of, you know, being treated like a number within this kind of bureaucratic process. So I think art kind of gives people a certain amount of power back, or validation, or, you know, the ability to be seen. So yeah, that's one example that I can think of. A young girl from Eritrea made really interesting comics that were sort of Lynchian and weird, of about like crying babies and levitating princesses and stuff like that.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and then there were, you know, I tried actually just to, it ended up being most of the time just a communal drawing exercise where people drew what they wanted and I would help them and I would also draw. So, you know, in the beginning, I thought it would be maybe more of a straightforward comic workshop like I've conducted with other people. But I think everybody kind of wanted something different. And, you know, drawing is so multifaceted and people can get different things from it. So I think one surprising aspect of the workshops was that people wanted different things and could explore differently within drawing. They drew princesses and they also drew painful memories, you know, like butterflies and ships and stuff like that. But it was nice. I think one thing that the workshops did provide was sort of a respite from the chaos that was going on at the time. And I think that was good. You know, and there are, were also, because Berlin has so many creative people, there were also different kinds of workshops that were happening at the same time. And even now, like a friend of mine has a really cool boat building workshops with asylum seekers. Yeah. Yeah.
We're kind of living in a moment right now where immigrants are this bogeyman.
Yeah.
And it's been less so in Germany. Germany's been relatively progressive. Mm-hmm. But that's really strained the political system there. So you've seen that happen firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, that's like in 2015, obviously Angela Merkel made this really big, beautiful, moral gesture of welcoming people, you know.
And that's the Prime Minister of Germany at the moment.
Right, the Chancellor of Germany. Yeah, at the moment. And she got this huge backlash from within her center-right party for this decision. And since then, you know, has walked it back. So I think, you know, close to a million people sought asylum in Germany in 2015. And the next year, it was less than half of that. And then there were stricter regulations about, you know, whether people who were granted refugee status could bring their families with them. And it's much, much harder now than it was a year or two ago. So yes, Germany is progressive in comparison to America in terms of like asylum status, but it's gotten progressively less progressive or less welcoming, I should say, which is sad because in the beginning there was this slogan that Angela Merkel had that's like, yes, we can do it, or, you know, we're able to do it. Yeah, I mean, I think she was trying to be a little Obama-esque. Yeah, and she had her moment where she... where that was, and you really felt it. I mean, Berlin is a specific place, but you felt a sense of community bonded by volunteerism and wanting to accept people. And I knew quite a few people who had extra rooms, sort of giving them to asylum seekers. It was a beautiful moment. And then a lot of people also doing creative workshops like the ones that I conducted. And it felt, yeah, it felt a little, again, like maybe 2008, like there was this optimism for kind of a shared, brighter future, sort of a multi-ethnic, multi-religious society in the same place, you know, where so much barbarism had happened, like, you know, creating something new. I think that was sort of the sense in 2015. And I think also, you know, economically, it made sense for Germany. There was a lack of people who like could fill certain jobs. I mean, the economy actually grew because of the influx of people, you know, and they were doing a relatively good job of sort of integrating and educating people. But politically, you know, refugees became this thing that kind of weighed down Angela Merkel's party, or herself, actually, within the party. Yeah. For those of us who, you know, are more interested in open border policies, we kind of thought that maybe Germany would be a bulwark to this kind of rising nationalism. And I think it was for a while, but I think the last year or two, it's really kind of succumbed to the same ascendant nativism that's like, or tribalism that's really gripping, I don't know, the world. Yeah.
Do you think these countries like Hungary and Poland and to some extent Germany feel like they're getting permission watching America, you know, the great 800-pound gorilla with Trump running rampant?
Oh, for sure. I think a lot of the like right-wing, far right-wing parties in Europe were emboldened by Trump's win. And I mean, for instance, Hungary is like completely fascist now. I mean, I actually interviewed some guys because of this statue that was erected by Viktor Orban in the middle of the night in Budapest. And they were like, you know, we don't have a free press anymore. They were journalists and couldn't write. I mean, and in Budapest is sort of a little island, but even within that island, it's really like the regime is so repressive and rewriting the constitution.
At the Portland Book Festival, you were on a panel with Jason Lutz, who has this epic graphic novel, a fictional story set in late 1920s Berlin.
Right. Yeah.
So both you and Jason have these moments in your books where you go back a century and bring up the refugee crisis a century ago when Jews from Eastern Europe were fleeing pogroms and civil war in what became the Soviet Union. And the parallels are striking. There's people coming from the East who are civilians, our children, our families, and are fleeing barbarism.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know that the parallels would be quite so striking until I read Joseph Roth's journalism from the time. So that was between, he wrote for the Berliner Zeitung between 1920 and 1933. And I think to also go back to Jason's book, you know, I like that in his book you can sort of feel the weight of fascism coming, you know, this sort of like pre-fascist.
Although he's very subtle about it, he avoids using swastikas, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that sort of the air of oppression, you know, is really present in his work, which is interesting and very apt for our current moment. I think that period is super interesting, super apt, and very chilling to look at right now. The moment, sort of not the calm before the storm, but the gathering of the storm, I guess. And so when I started reading Joseph Roth's journalism, I was struck by his language, which felt shockingly contemporary to me. You know, the way he approached subjects and the people he was writing about, these sort of these marginalized communities, was with, you know, a certain respect and sensitivity that it felt very striking considering it was written in, you know, like 1918 or 1920 or whatever. Yeah, and he sort of followed around different communities, and some of the ones that he shadowed, which I write about in Drawn to Berlin, were people who were fleeing pogroms in Galicia, which is now Ukraine, and Russia, and other places in the East. And, you know, back then, Berlin also was this place of transience and people were moving to and through it. And actually, a lot of people got stuck there on their way to Hamburg or America, you know. And he actually, Joseph Roth, writes about how difficult it was to gain asylum in America back then, and how sort of the European dream was actually more achievable than the American dream for a lot of people, which I think is still true. And I mean, the parallels are many. And he also sort of, Joseph Roth writes about the dominance of a certain kind of bureaucracy, how the Greek fates have been replaced by sort of bureaucrats that decide, you know, the shape of your life based on papers. And that's something that I felt strongly when I was speaking to people who, you know, in the refugee shelter, who really struggled intensely with papers and with paperwork and bureaucracy, and they were waiting for the next, in German it's called like a Schein, their next permission, you know, to work, to live, to leave the shelter, to get an apartment. It's a painful and like Kafkaesque process to watch. You know, back to the 20s, I think that the parallels were numerous. And also one other parallel that I wanted to mention is the rhetoric in the press of the 1920s. So back then. They didn't, I mean, they did actually, I think, maybe call it a refugee crisis at some point, but they called it like peril from the East, you know, these people who were coming. So it was cast in this already really dark light. And Joseph Roth writes about how people sort of were scared of the religious zealotry of people who were coming from the East, and headscarves in particular, which I think is, you know, a very visual, clear link to how sometimes, you know, like Germany banned, I think I can't remember if they banned the hijab in certain areas, like schools or something. Angela Merkel did it for like political reasons about a year or two ago. These kind of parallels and how we talk about it were really striking to me too.
Well, Berlin gets a bad rap. People think of the Berlin Wall, they think of Hitler. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not really fair. We mentioned Jason Lutz and his graphic novel, Berlin, and he points out that Hitler hated Berlin. Mm-hmm. Hitler was from Austria. Mm-hmm. His supporters were from southern Germany. And Berlin, during the Weimar Republic in the 20s, was this very open and sort of libertine place. A lot of queer culture, a lot of avant-garde art and music. And that tradition remains today.
Yeah. I would say so. I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons I moved to Berlin is because I had this, I'd read Christopher Isherwood's Berlin Diaries when I was, I don't know, in my teens.
Which was adapted into the stage play Cabaret.
Yes, indeed. And actually there is a Kit Kat Club, which I mentioned in my graphic novel. It's this kind of Berlin mythos as a site of bohemia and queerness and sort of counterculture and in a general kind of openness, and acceptance. I think that lives on. You know, I think nobody really cares in Berlin what you do. I mean, you can do a lot of stuff without people paying very much attention to you. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure, but it sort of seems like there has been a zeitgeist over the last 15 years in Berlin where it's become, again, sort of this Weimar era, almost like Bacchanalian place. And a site of a lot of sort of people who are looking for that.
And Berlin's a good place to be a satirist, especially a political satirist.
Yes, that's true. It has a really, I mean, especially in terms of specifically drawing. I think of, George Gross and Kathy Kollwitz and Hannah Hoch. Actually, one thing I really like is that sometimes a friend of mine will go to this flea market and pick up these old German like cartoon books, and some of those have like really interesting Berlin specific satire that are from maybe, I don't know, between the 20s and the 50s. And Berlin had a really rich and I didn't even know this actually, had a really rich history of city specific kind of cartooning. These sort of like wordless kind of slapstick cartoons about Berlin city life that sometimes I like to look at. But yeah, in terms of the people that I look at for my own work, you know, I think Kathy Kollwitz has these like beautiful drawings and etchings and she did sculptures of, you know, communities in Berlin and communities during the war and between the wars. They're moving, and I think that they show how craft can sometimes really communicate profundity in like a very specific way. Yeah.
I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and you're listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in 2018 and featuring comics artist Ollie Fitzgerald. At the time of this interview, Ollie had just released the graphic memoir Drawn to Berlin, Comic Workshops in Refugee Shelters, and Other Stories from a New Europe. Well, people who follow your comic stories in the New Yorker will see a lot of satire. You do some mashups, you do some takedowns, you have Ayn Rand making appearances and other cultural figures.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I remember when I was doing Hungover Bear and Friends, I had a character called Ant Rand that was just an ant, which I really liked. I think in that one, Ayn Rand gives fall fashion advice. I think that was pretty funny. I did one with like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's like Summer Beach Party. I mean, the column is America, so I try to find different, like, angles about how to talk about America, but, you know, I like to keep it pretty fresh. I did one comic about how Donald Trump and I have the same favorite song. which is Peggy Lee's Is That All There Is? You know, living outside of America gives you a little bit of distance on America. And I think satire becomes not easier, but there are certain things that seem a little bit clearer from a distance. I think the column itself helps me dissect and digest certain thoughts that I have about America through satire, which is nice.
And then you've got some New Yorker pieces mm-hmm. that are certainly more straightforward, mm-hmm. You know, straightforward mm-hmm. history and culture. Yeah. Like one of the pieces I'm thinking of is the rise and fall and return mm-hmm. of the Fraktur font.
Right.
That typeface was everywhere mm-hmm. in early 20th century Berlin. Yeah. Some people might think of it as sort of an old German kind mm-hmm. of calligraphy font. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you bring together politics and art, mm-hmm. Specifically the art of typography.
Yeah, that was a really exciting. So that's a chapter from the book. And that was a really exciting chapter to make. And it was an exciting chapter to research also. I remember sort of getting in this font hole for like 2 weeks and just being, oh my God, like so many different fonts that are so political. Like, how can this all be related? You know, and the idea of aesthetics and politics like sort of being linked in ways that we can kind of like look at and talk about is really exciting to me. So actually, I'm kind of working on that now, you know, for a future book.
Well, the Fraktur font, people look at it nowadays and right. they think of Nazi Germany, but
right.
actually it was mm-hmm. a font that Hitler hated at the time and was considered mm-hmm. too Jewish.
Right. Well, I think he liked it at first. And then at some point sort of switched. And I think it's because in 1941, you know, Germany was sort of taking over the world and he wanted a font that was more legible. And Antiqua, which is like a Danish font, was more legible. So he kind of wanted to switch. And then, you know, then accused it of being too romantic. And other people, I think, accused it of being, you know, a Jewish font. And yeah, Goebbels also like wrote, you know, in his diary about sort of the advantages of Antiqua versus Fraktur. And it was this whole kind of debate that was happening around fonts, you know, in the middle of the war. And I think more than anything, that kind of shows the importance that they placed on visuals and propaganda, you know, the fact that, yeah, in the middle of this war, they were talking about fonts is really crazy. Yeah. And then, you know, after the war, it was really taboo to use that font for the most part. And, when I first moved to Berlin, I don't remember really seeing the font very often, except maybe if you went outside of Berlin to these kind of small dorfs or towns, you know, maybe you would see them there in like beer halls or something. But then the first time I remember seeing it and being struck by it was actually by this interesting avant-garde community theater. And they used it actually as a provocation. They knew that using the font would be provocative. And it was. And people were like, whoa, you know, they saw this font. And I think it elicited things in people that that they were surprised by and maybe like didn't understand because we overlook fonts so often. And then since then, I think, you know, there has been a kind of resurgence. And I do think that, you know, part of it is because a certain kind of nationalism is becoming mainstream in Germany and is becoming okay. You know, some people argue that since the, I think, 2006 or 10, like Germany won the World Cup and suddenly patriotism was back on the table. Like Germans were allowed to have patriotism again. And I think, you know, there are arguments to be made that aesthetics have also sort of have gone hand in hand with this, the okayness of like a renewed sense of German pride.
Well, you're based in Berlin these days, but you travel around a lot. You've led visual storytelling workshops in Germany, in England, at the famous Shakespeare and Company on the Left Bank in Paris. Yeah. And you've been involved with the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art mm-hmm. on a series of graphic works about Magritte, the surrealist.
Yeah, that was really fun. I've given visual storytelling workshops quite a bit the last year or two. And I've actually spent more time outside of Berlin this year. So I spent a lot of time in Paris. I was on a residency. Also, like on the residency, I was looking at the visuals of French propaganda, for instance, which was super interesting.
Was this the late 19th century era of the Dreyfus Affair, things like that?
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah, and also like Daumier and a lot of sort of caricaturists were around like you know, they were at their height during this sort of Dreyfus Affair era. Yeah, but I also looked at sort of competing propaganda posters during World War II because, you know, Paris was occupied, but it had a huge sort of resistance. So there were these competing propaganda posters in the 1940s. And other things too, like how the symbol of Joan of Arc has been, you know, taken alternately by different political parties in France. And now like the right wing sort of has Joan of Arc. That's sort of a, and you know, all of these right wing demonstrations happen around the Joan of Arc statue. She kind of symbolizes a certain kind of Frenchness. But during the Vichy era, they taught that, you know, Joan of Arc was great, but like that women shouldn't be like her. They should just like aspire to her nationalist pride, but like, you know, not be boyish and warrior like. Yeah, which is an interesting sort of mental division to have.
So is there anything new on the horizon?
Yeah, well, I'm working on these different vignettes about the aesthetics of propaganda, and I hope at some point to turn that into a book. But I'm also working on like a YA graphic novel about time travel. I think that's a nice, like, I can't quite go into like serious nonfiction routes at the moment. I think it's nice kind of, I mean, for me to balance fiction and nonfiction. So I have my monthly comic with The New Yorker, and then I do, you know, different comics for different people. Like one for The Guardian that will come out in December is about actually the where the Berlin Wall used to be and how that became an unintentional kind of nature preserve, you know, the species that thrived there. There were different biomes, different kinds of mushrooms that grew, you know, on different sides. And yeah, the same people who sort of ended up documenting this green space after the wall fell are getting ready, if ever the wall falls, between North and South Korea to also kind of like go in there and, you know, investigate this unintentional nature preserve, which ends up with the Berlin Wall specifically, the militarized border that separated East and West Germany that extended beyond Berlin. You know, it was spared the industrial farming of other places. So all kinds of endangered birds actually like made their way to that part and you know, were kind of allowed to thrive there. So yeah, it's a super interesting story about borders, I think, a different way to look at borders. Not that I'm advocating for them. I'm not. But anyway, so those are a couple of the projects that I have on the burner, individual comics like that, and then the two very, very different book projects are what I'm working on at the moment.
Well, the book is Drawn to Berlin, Comic Workshops in Refugee Shelters and Other Stories from a New Europe. Mm-hmm. It's a graphic memoir out now from Fantagraphic Books. The author is Ali Fitzgerald. Ali, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. It was interesting to talk about all these things.
And for those listeners who'd like to find out more about you and your other books and projects, mm-hmm. where can they look?
Well, you can look on The New Yorker for all the comics by me, Ali Fitzgerald. My sort of updated website, AliFitzgerald.net. Yeah, or on Instagram, I'm AliFitzgerald80s. And on Twitter, I'm Ali G. Fitzgerald.
You've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today, recorded in November of 2018, is comics artist Ali Fitzgerald. At the time of this interview, Ali had just released the graphic memoir Drawn to Berlin, Comic Workshops in Refugee Shelters, and Other Stories from a New Europe. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.